Hey everyone, I have a question. Are you listening to this episode on Himalaya? If you are, awesome, because you're already using the best new podcast app out there. If you're not, you're missing out. Not only does Himalaya have a ton of cool features like curated podcast lists and collections, along with personalized recommendations, but our new members-only version of the Professor Is In podcast is only available on the Himalaya app. So be sure and download it, check it out, and keep an eye out for our members-only content. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Professor Is In podcast. I am Kel Weinhold. You can find me on all social media at K-E-L-W-E-I-N-H-O-L-D.
And I am Dr. Karen Kelski, and you can find me on Twitter at Professor Is In, and of course on Facebook at the large and dynamic community of The Professor Is In on Facebook. And of course, on our website, theprofessorisin.com. So today, we are delighted to introduce our very first guest to the podcast, Dr. Roxanne Donovan, professor of psychology at Kennesaw State University and co-founder of the business, The Well Academic, which you can find online at wellacademic.com. Dr. Donovan, thank you so much for coming to be with us today.
I am so excited and very excited to be your first guest. I'm honored and humbled.
Well, we feel likewise, and also want to extend our thanks to you for the for your patience through the many attempts to get the technology right.
Yes, we're learning as we go, people, and that should tell all of you in the PhD process that it's progress, not perfection. Just keep working at it. You'll get there.
Learning is rarely a straight line, and I'm glad you tamed the tech beast.
Oh, tell you, at least for the moment. So could you just give us the primer on Well Academic and how it came to be and what you're hoping to accomplish with it?
Well, thanks for asking. Well Academic came to be because of pain. I wish I could give a more optimistic story than that, but my fabulous bestie, Joycelyn Moody, who also happens to be the co-founder of Well Academic, and I do a lot of mentoring and a lot of workshops related to thriving in academe. And we've just kept hearing and seeing the same thing over and over again, just the pain and the struggle and the strife that academics were experiencing, particularly academics of color and other minoritized academics, and the loneliness and the isolation within that pain. And so Joycelyn and I thought, you know what? We have experience as coaches and we have expertise. I'm a clinical psychologist and I study the impact of gendered racism on women of color and other people of color. And so we put our heads together and thought, you know what? We should do something that concentrates on the intersection of work and well-being. And that's how Well Academic came to be. And that's why well is first, right? Because you can't have sustained productivity and sustained success without sustained health.
That's fantastic. So I understand that you offer retreats. Is that right?
Yeah, you know what? We're about to do our fourth Women of Color faculty retreat. And in fact, we just launched the registration the other day, and it is a heart project. And I'm sure you two know this because you speak so lovingly about The Professor Is In, and you talk about how it is your heart and your soul project, not just something that you do, not just work. And it's the same thing for Joycelyn and me. And we actually started out just doing workshops on campuses and coaching. And we loved doing both of those things, but I'll give you a little bit of the origin story of the retreat. I do a lot of teaching as it relates to mindfulness, which means that I do a lot of learning as it relates to mindfulness and other mindfulness-related well-being practices. And so I was taking a class for a therapist on mindfulness, mindfulness-based stress reduction in particular. And part of that class was a retreat in the beautiful mountains of Georgia, a silent retreat. And so I pack my bags and I go up to this beautiful retreat center, and we're in the silent retreat, and I'm looking around, and I am the only person of color, the mm-hmm. only woman of color. There was not even another tan white person. And I was like, this is familiar, right? We're in this place that is about healing and loving kindness, mm-hmm. and how you have to give yourself loving kindness and give loving kindness out into the world. And I'm looking around and I'm thinking, I'm feeling really vulnerable. It's supposed mm-hmm. to be this place of safety and of love. And because I'm the only, it's making me feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so when we broke silence, I talked to the two fabulous women who were leading the retreat. And I mentioned this, you know, first of all, how can you enact loving kindness when you are in a place of oppression, of systemic oppression, of structural oppression? And secondly, you know, why am I the only person of color here? Like, what are y'all doing to reach out to people of color, women of color? And, you know, they did their best to answer the question. And I mean, it was a fair answer, but it didn't really meet what I was needing as an answer. And it was troubling, and I wasn't at peace. Mm-hmm. So I'm driving off the mountain, troubled, mm-hmm. and not at peace when I'm supposed to be. And I thought to myself, you know, I wish there were a place for women of color that is about healing, that is just for women of color. And by the time I reached the bottom of the mountain, I was like, you know what, if that place doesn't exist, Joycelyn and I can build it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to build what we wish we had. Uh-huh. And that's how the retreat came about. And Joycelyn, being the beautiful human that she is, she was like, no, we can't wait 2 years to build this. Let's do this right now. The need is right now. It was, you know, right after the Trump election and, you know, all the things. So we did, we created this thing and people came. Mm-hmm. And it was healing, and we did it again, and more people came, and it was healing. And so, yeah, we're going to do this every year as long as people keep coming and getting meaning and healing from the experience.
That is so great to hear. And just to reiterate for our listeners, the registration is now live for this one that's coming up. Is that right?
It's live for Well Academic members, and membership is free. And it becomes live for the general public, April 1st.
All right.
So a little bit from now.
All right, everybody, be sure and check that out. I have an immediate...
Oh, thanks for boosting.
Of course. Are you kidding? That's what we're about here. The professor is in. I have so many follow-ups. Okay, I'm going to mention a follow-up, but I just want to put a pin in this one. And then I want to ask my actual follow-up. The one with the pin in it is...
This is a comment more than a question.
Don't you find it weird that that one can do more good in the world running a mission-driven business than in the putatively high moral ground of the academy? That was certainly my experience. But I want to put a pin in that, because I don't think that's as helpful to our listeners as what I'm about to ask you, which is far more pertinent, which is, why do women of color need a healing retreat? Women of color in the academy.
You got 4 hours? Okay, so first of all, let me do a caveat. I always have to do this. I need to make a caveat before I get into this, and that is that although we're about to talk about the ways women of color can enact healing, I want to be clear that it is healing because we're in systems and structures and institutions that don't recognize our full humanity. Mm-hmm. And that causes pain. And so I don't want to be one of those people that like, oh, you just do X, Y, and Z and you will be whole. Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to be whole in a nation, in a world that doesn't always recognize us as whole. Right. So our goal at Well Academic is not to make it seem like all change is within your power. Mm-hmm. That would be a lie.
Right.
We're about just elbowing out a little bit more room between the rock and the hard place so that we can live in a place of valued action as much as that is possible. Mm-hmm. Again, that elbowing out is about, you know, valuing as much as possible all of the trauma that comes at us to allow just some space between the pain and the response, which is that place of freedom, right? It's the place of being able to turn to these traumas and respond to them in ways that are aligned with our values and not just about being triggered because of pain. So I say that caveat, but
I really appreciate that too.
Oh, thank you. Why do women of color faculty need a retreat? Well, for the things that I just said, you know, we're at institutions that don't always recognize our wholeness. We interact with people who enact microaggressions, macroaggressions against us. Our work isn't always valued. In fact, sometimes it is marginalized and trivialized if we're doing social justice work. In the academy, the academy just wasn't made for us, literally. Mm-hmm. It was not made for us. And so we transform and transgress this place by being there, just who we are by being there. But, you know, when you transgress a place, when your very body is considered other, it's painful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes we can recognize that pain, but most of the time, when you're in a stressful environment, our bodies don't always signal this is stress. You're having a stress response.
Right.
Sometimes it's subtle and sometimes it's not, but it's not a one-to-one correlation. So if we can't sleep, we don't think, oh, it's all of these little indignities that I have to put up with. It's policies that don't recognize me. It's barriers I have to climb over that are much higher and much wider and much more dangerous than people who are more privileged, right? We don't, mm-hmm. it's not a one-to-one correlation like that. We don't see it or understand it, but the pain we're internalizing nonetheless.
Yeah.
And it comes out in ways like difficulty sleeping, eating too much or eating too little. It comes out in body pain, in migraines, in ways that, like I said, can be subtle, and sometimes it can be really, really loud, but by that point, it can be harder to manage. Mm-hmm. You know, think hypertension or diabetes, mm-hmm. all those things are made worse by stress. And so we want to come in right where people are to try to help them see the structures and the systems and the institutional barriers, right? Because it's hard to see. And so it's clear for some people, but not so clear for others. And also create a community of other women in color so that people can speak their truth in a place of safety. Because, you know, swallowing our feelings, which is very much what we're taught to do, you know, right. Be strong. Head down, mm-hmm. keep going. You know, the strong Black woman is something I actually study. And
right.
in my studies and all of the other studies related to the strong Black woman, or almost all of the other studies, show that the more we engender this like idea of stoicism and strength at all costs, the more it damages us.
Right.
And so we need a place to let it out. We need to like open the valves to let the pressure out a little bit. We need to be our authentic selves. We need to take off our armor and to just feel that weightlessness a little bit. Because the armor is good, right? The armor is protective. It doesn't let the pain in a little bit, but it also doesn't allow us to truly connect with other people. So Well Academic is not only about healing from here's what the barriers are, here's what the stressors are, and here's what the research says. Mm-hmm. can help, but it's also about here's the community.
Right.
And here's a place for you to enact authenticity because we know you have to be performative out in the world.
So as you're saying this, I'm sort of visualizing this pretty dramatic intersection of the toxicity of academia in its individualizing problems, in its saying this is not working because of you, the individual. rather than looking at the systemic problems of racism, misogyny, homophobia, the marginalized, what marginalized, traditionally marginalized groups are dealing with. And it's crashing right into that strong Black woman narrative. So that I can see how it could very quickly become individualized in people's in people's experience.
Yeah, right. Because how do you know?
Right.
These things can be, sometimes they're overt, don't get me wrong, but sometimes they're so subtle, it's crazy making. Mm. And so if you're performing perfectionism, or if you have a sense that you're less than in some way, it's like, oh, there's something wrong with me because I feel like I have to be perfect, or I feel like an imposter. But there's no real accounting for the fact that when you don't belong in an academic space, when your group is not seen as quote unquote intellectual, you're stereotyped as other, as less than, of course, a very natural and rational response, if you're in this place, if you've gotten these messages because you've grown up in the U.S. all your life, that you're less than because you're not a white man, a white cis man, right? Straight man, right? So you're getting these messages, and it's in the education setting, it's in how you're treated, and it's typically nuanced because you're socialized in this place, and socialization can be really nuanced. And so, of course, if you're not thriving in academe when, you know, the white man next to you is thriving in academe, you're going to be like, well, there's something wrong with me.
Right.
I have some individual deficits.
Right.
And it's only when you talk to lots of women of color, you see a very similar narrative, not the same, but very, very similar, you realize you're not crazy.
Right.
But there's so few of us in academe that we usually, there's not enough of us to come together to and to be real. And sometimes the pain of gendered racism is such that you might internalize whiteness, and it may become that other women of color are your enemy. And so in this way, you're isolated even more.
Right.
And only in places of compassionate sisterhood can you really unpack all of that trauma, all of that pain, and be like, oh, yes, it is me. I'm an individual, but I'm individual interacting with structures and systems and institutions. So it's not an individual deficit. It is intersectional in exactly the way that you just said, Kel.
Yeah. And it reminds me of something that I'm so grateful for you that in one of our previous attempts to record this, that the idea that if you get off course, if you're working on something and for some reason you stop working on it, you get off course. Because we were talking as working on productivity. And you sort of corrected my thinking on that about, look, if you exist in one of these marginalized groups, you don't get off course, you're pushed off course.
Yes, it's the belief that valued living, right? Living our values, which requires, again, that space between the trigger and the stressor and your reaction, because you don't actually want some reflexive response. You want a thoughtful response. That means there's the thing about values, right? There's no destination. Valued living is an ongoing journey. We call it a journeying. And so you're on this journey path, right? It's the path that you want for yourself. It's like when you're finally sleeping the hours you need to sleep and you're eating right and you're exercising, then something happens, right? The winds come and blow you right off course. And people think, oh, crap. And there's all this self-blame and shame. Oh, now I'm not sleeping again. Oh, I'm eating really badly. I'm not exercising again. I can't believe I did this to myself. There's all this I talk. But those wins, more than not, they're not about us. It's like structural systemic gendered racism just happened. Right?
Right.
And you've been blown right off course, but it is not your doing, right? It's not like we have the wind at our back pushing us along the healthy path. Even in the best of circumstances, we're facing a headwind. And sometimes the winds are just stay on course. But this is why having, you know, a practice, having a community allows you to find your way back. Like the values are your compass, right? To find, to constantly finding your way back. And this is what I tell my clients all the time. It is, the work is not about getting on the path and staying on the path. Like that would be in an ideal setting where all of us are equal. Right? Mm-hmm. We live in an egalitarian society. Mm-hmm. And that's not the society we live in right now. So the goal is always the finding your way back. And values are that compass to find your way back.
I just love that because it reminds me of, I have a very extremely inconsistent and intermittent meditation practice that is more non-existent than existent. But what I love most about it and what has been enduringly transformative about it is the understanding that meditation is not you get in, you sit, and you get into the some enlightened state, and then, woohoo, I'm there. Woo, yay, I did it. I'm meditating now. It's actually, and even the masters, like Pema Chodron, say the same thing, that what it's about is, oh, your mind just flew off. Like, she has a liner, she's in L.A. Like, suddenly I'm in L.A.
Right, exactly.
I'm in an argument in L.A. in my mind. and pulling it back, and that the pulling it back is the meditation, mm-hmm. and is the practice. It isn't some destination where you have achieved enlightenment.
But it's hard, right?
Oh, because, it's so hard.
And I think it's particularly hard for women of color because many of us are taught to grit it out,
mm-hmm.
right? And you can do it. You just need to be stronger, mm-hmm. and you need to work harder, and you need to be twice as good to get half as far. And these are the messages that we internalize. So rightfully so, right? We need to be strong to withstand the trauma that comes at us,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, for sure.
Right.
But what that does when you're thinking that you need to grit it all out and that you have to engender strength is there's so little self-compassion.
Right.
So little gentleness. And so when things go bad, and like I said, they will go bad,
mm-hmm.
right? And many times not because of anything you did.
Right.
You're watching a movie and then all of a sudden you're triggered because there's some racist drama happening or misogynistic drama happening to the woman of color on the screen.
Right.
It's like I always say, I have these black feminist moments all the time when I just want to be. I don't want to have a black feminist moment. I just want to be Roxanne, hanging out, doing nothing, and then something happens.
Right.
It's like, oh, here we go again, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
yes, strength is necessary. But when things start popping off, it is so necessary to be gentle with yourself and have self-compassion,
mm-hmm.
because in that self-compassion is the possibility of getting back to the sleep, of getting back to the eating well, of getting back to focusing on family or whatever is important. The more we chastise ourselves, the harsher we are with ourselves, you know, that perfectionistic thing that I talked about earlier,
mm-hmm.
the harder it is then to do the behaviors. Self-compassion inadvertently, right? You don't think that this is what it does. You think being gentle with yourself means that you're going to end up definitely not doing what you're supposed to. But that's not what the research shows. The gentler you are with yourself, the more you can get back on track.
Yeah, I see.
And the harder you are with yourself, it's like that slide downhill. It's like when you have that one cookie. And you're like, forget it, the diet's over. And then next thing you know, three boxes of Girl Scout cookies in, right. It's like the end of the world.
right. And, you know, I think that I see this a lot with the people that we talk to and that we work with, this all or nothing bar. And I feel like, and Karen and I talk about it a lot, about how do people self-select into the academy with that sense of driven and or sort of a punitive system, so they're used to it.
Self-punishing, all or nothing.
Right. And the constant, well, it wasn't exactly what it was supposed to be, so it was a failure. I work with a thing called a minimal viable product. Like how, I want your work to be MVP. What I want it to be is not, you cannot make it perfect, but you can meet the bar that's being set without making yourself ill. I would love to hear a little bit about that, Because I feel like that context shifts dramatically when we start talking about women of color, of what MVP, what the bar is, because it's inherently higher.
So much higher.
You know, that is such a good point, and I'm glad that you realize that positionality matters, not only in how one views what the product should be, but in how the observer recognizes that product as good enough.
Right?
And because women of color are stereotyped in a variety of ways, depending on their positionality, as well as the other identities beyond race and gender that intersects for their positionality, it many times is that the bar is higher for whomever they're writing for, from whomever their reviewers are. I know people say, but it's double blind review or whatever people say. But if you're writing about social justice and you're writing about, for example, women of color, I often get all kinds of things when my writing is social justice related versus when it's just straight up psych. And it's the bar is higher. I'm the same person writing, so it's not like my writing all of a sudden got really bad in this one area, but all of a sudden I'm being asked to do more. I'm being asked to have another, don't just look at Black women. Why don't you compare Black women to white women? Where is the theory? You only talked about this theory. What about all this other stuff? And it's usually when I'm publishing my work in more mainstream journals. I rarely get this when I'm publishing in journals specifically for people of color, like when I'm publishing in Black psychology, for example. But when I'm publishing in mainstream journals, the bar is really, really high when I'm writing about Black women or other women of color. And so, yeah, the minimum viable product shifts, right? It shifts. And so the work then becomes acknowledging the differential barriers that people have depending on their positionality. Like, that's real, and pretending it's not real is just increasing the pain, right? That's real. And how do you respond to that in ways that are still healthy? And it's a challenge because we don't have these conversations in these systems. I rarely hear these conversations about, you know, how we treating scholars of color or individuals who are doing work related to social justice topics in mainstream journals. I don't hear journal boards talking about this a lot. And we need to, because a recent study said women, and I may be getting this wrong, but I don't, because I don't have the numbers in front of me, but women make up about 86% of the articles compared to every 100% of men's articles. But I don't know how to say that, but 0.86 to every 1.0. And so there's a gender gap. And I bet if you look at race by gender, it would be so much more and disproportionate considering how many women of color they are in our population. And so, yeah, it's a balancing act. And there is no like great answer, because I can't say gendered racism doesn't exist and you're treated the same. I can't say that. But I also know that trying to get something to 100% each and every time is going to really slow people down.
Right.
So I think for me, it's about, okay, who do you have to share your work with? What other women do you have to share your work with that can help you in the process? So who's your community? Who also understands what these barriers are, right? And who can tell you when it's good enough? Because it's really hard when it, when it's just you. Which is why having Joycelyn as a Well Academic co-founder is amazing, because she was an editor for a considerable part of her life. And she was an editor for a journal. So she can really say, yes, this is good enough. And so having those external eyes and perspectives becomes very, very important, because internally, it's never enough. It's never good enough.
And then there's all the issue of tenure. and the expectation, not just, you know, the second tier level of this, of not just what happens when you're trying to publish and the reviews you're getting and the acceptance rates, but then how those acceptances stack up to being a sufficient viable product for your tenure case. And how, I will never forget when I arrived at University of Illinois, and I was, oh no, it was after I was made department head. So I was invited to this big campus-wide event that they held at the beginning of every year. And it was big reception. The chancellor was there and everything. And then what they would do is they would call up all the people, maybe it was in spring, they would call up all the people who were newly hired. And that would be, you know, it was a big campus. So there were like 100 people there. And it was this great mosaic of diversity, right?
It was really
I mean, it still wasn't exactly saying. Like 50%, but still there was a lot of diversity there. And then they called up the people who were newly tenured to associate. And suddenly it was, of course, a much smaller number. But then all of a sudden it was, you know, 75% white men, or like 60% white men, you know, 30% white women, and, you know, 10% somewhat, you know, other minoritized faculty members. And then they would call up the people who had been promoted to full. And what were we looking at?
White men.
Yep. White men. And I've never seen such a visible manifestation of the way that sexism and racism and gendered racism works in the academy as that. So, and of course, following the stories of so many women of color, like the woman at Harvard who was just turned down scandalously for tenure a couple months ago.
It's painful, right? And I mean, it's not only when you don't get tenure, maybe you're still striving, but when you see, it's called vicarious trauma, right? When you see what's happening to other people, your body responds as if it is happening to you.
Right.
And it's not only what's happening in the academy, it's what's happening writ large in the nation right now. And all of these things are stressing and weighing on us. It's vicarious traumatization by vicarious traumatization by vicarious traumatization. You know, I could not watch the video of this 6-year-old black girl being put in handcuffs. And I literally said to myself, I cannot watch this.
Right.
Because I need at this moment to protect myself from that imagery.
Yes.
And it's like, these are the things, right? These are the things. They're painful and they're hurting us. Mm-hmm. Right. And how do you function healthily in a space like this? You know, it's not going to be natural.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's going to require a lift, a significant lift, to try to maintain health. And for me, it's not like maintain 100% health. It's for me, and this is what I say to my clients, it's about barriering as much as you can, because the stuff's going to come through.
Right.
But you want to protect yourself as much as possible from damaging your body, your mind, your psyche, your spirit. And that also means enacting or bringing about positive emotions. And so part of the work is not only about how do you like cope with the challenges so that you don't get injured as deeply, but on the other side of it is how do you maintain and enact those things that bring you joy? Because it is so easy to forget that.
That's
the thing about stoicism, by the way. Like, if you try to bury the negative, like, I'm stuffing down the sadness and the depression and the vulnerability and the rage. The rage can be real, right? I'm going to stuff it down because I can't act on it. Mm-hmm. What also gets stuffed down, and we don't really think about it, but what also gets pushed down is our capacity for joy and happiness and connection and love. Mm-hmm. And so all we end up being is numb people, like actors on a stage, just performing our life and not feeling anything. And I think we deserve better than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are ways, right? There are lots of science behind this. There are ways to foster positive emotions, even in the face of challenge and strife.
Like what?
And by the way, let me
just preface this by saying that the question I was going to ask, so I'm going to ask these two together, is that for all of our listeners who can't get to the lovely hills of Georgia for a retreat with you. And I bet everybody is, a lot of people are checking flights right now. if they can't, what are some practices that you recommend they pursue, in particular the one of fostering joy?
So, you know, some of them are fairly simple, but hard to conceptualize that something so simple can make a difference. But gratitude is one of those things. Gratitude has been shown to reduce stress, increase appreciation, increase joy. And when I say gratitude, I mean looking at the things in your life that may go unnoticed, like the kiss that your son may have given you before leaving the car to go to school. Mm-hmm. The smile that the stranger gave you when you were passing by, or the hello, or the sunshine, or the warm shower, or the fact that you got out of bed not feeling pain that day. Like, I'm talking about the little things that we might take for granted, because when you're stressed, when you feel threat, you literally become myopic. You begin to scan for threat, and you only recognize threat. So gratitude is this way of widening your vision to include the beautiful, positive things that are happening in your life. But because you're in a state of chronic stress, it becomes hard to do. So you're training your brain. So even writing three things every day, whether it's in the morning right when you get up, or in the evening right when you go to bed, three things that you're grateful for. And if you really want a stretch goal, you make it three different things every day. And do that just for 2 weeks. And consider how that might change how you scan the environment, how that might change your mindset to think about things differently. I mean, my gratitude practice keeps me whole, and we bring the gratitude practice to the retreat too. We talked about compassion before, self-compassion, but compassion can be a really good way of bringing joy into your life, right? Because compassion allows you to sometimes let go of that resentment and anger that comes from other people behaving in ways that you can't control. And so having compassion for yourself when you respond with rage, be like, oh, don't be mad at yourself for being angry, but reminding yourself that your natural emotional responses just make you human, right? And it makes you part of the beautiful human race, and then to have compassion for that, but not try to control it. It is impossible to control other people. We have tried for millennia. We can't, right? And we can't control our emotional experiences. So being mad at ourselves increases our suffering, right? So a bad situation is already bad, and then being mad at yourself for your emotional response just increases suffering all around. So having compassion for yourself allows a little bit more bandwidth then to bring in the joy and happiness in your life. It doesn't shut it down altogether. So self-compassion, compassion for others. And I, when I say compassion for others, I don't mean when people treat you badly. You're just like, okay, that's fine. I'm going to have compassion for you because you have a bad life. Like, okay, you can say when someone is treating you badly, you can say, I actually know this person's history and I understand that. And in fact, even when people are being racist towards me, I say to myself, if I have the same genetics, the same privilege, the same life that this person has or has had, the likelihood is I would be acting the same way. So I come from it from great humility. And I'm like, you can't do that. That's not allowed. Right? If someone like burns your house down, you can say, that's not okay. I may forgive you if it was an accident, if it were an accident, but I'm not giving you the keys to my house again. You know what I mean?
Right,
so
exactly.
A way that you can still boundary and have compassion. And I do that caveat because a lot of times when I talk about compassion, people think, oh, does that mean that I have to forgive and then stay in the situation? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Having understanding does not mean you don't set a boundary. And the last thing, and I think research has shown some quite robust results related to the importance of positive social support. I've called it community in the past, but positive social support is this balm that can heal the wounds that we experience in life. And you see, I said positive social support because sometimes our social support ain't too positive. Mm-hmm. In fact, sometimes the people in our life actually widen the wound or deepen the wound.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about people who you show your true self with, and they're like, love you, got you, with you. Mm-hmm. Like, those are the people that I'm talking about.
Right.
And to foster those type of relationships in a toxic space does require a level of vulnerability. So sometimes people in oppressed spaces can have a hard time seeing, especially if they're there, if you're say a woman of color in a predominantly white space, sometimes you could look around and say, well, I don't think I have that type of community that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes really important to figure out like how to build that community and be really, really intentional about it. In fact, tonight, right after we get off the call with each other, my family's having a pizza night in which we invite all of the people that we care about to come to our house and have a pizza night. Because we were like, you know what? We don't have the kind of ongoing connections with people outside of the office.
Right.
And to create that kind of connection requires like laughter and fun and families coming together. And so we built what we were wishing for. We were like, okay, we're going to have monthly pizza nights. And we're going to invite the people that we love and that we care about and that we see and may want to get to know better. And we're going to make that space for us here. And that's what we're doing tonight. And that's what we do the first week of every month. We have a pizza night.
That's awesome.
And again, intentional, because life can make it really hard to prioritize these things.
Right.
And so it requires intentionality, and it does, you know, community requires vulnerability. But I tell you, my community, they're my sister circle, they're the ones that keep me whole and well, and hopefully I do the same for them.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for, first of all, ending on such a instructive and here are some tools note. I am eternally grateful that you were here, that you shared your wisdom with our listeners, and just thank you.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesomeness. Yeah.
And can I say before we end that I do want to thank you both with my sincerest heart. I just cannot tell you how much it means to have you two want to lift up Black women businesses and then to do so with such integrity and wholeness. I am in awe. I hope you know that your ally work is felt in deep ways. And you have made, when we talk about compassion and community, you live those things and you bring them to life. And I deeply appreciate that. And I know your community does too.
Thank you so much for saying that. Well, Dr. Roxanne Donovan, we want to officially thank you for taking your time so very generously to speak with us today and a couple of other days.
Over and over again.
Repeatedably, until we got it right. And sharing your wisdom with us and giving Cal and me so much to think about and giving our podcast audience so much to think about, so much to work with, food for thought, plans and ideas for moving forward in a constructive way. You're really doing God's work. And I want to thank you for that. And yeah, we look forward to having you back.
My pleasure. I enjoyed every second.